Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. Most of Kansas City's recorded history goes back fairly earlier than the 1800s, when European Americans of French, Spanish, and British descent began settling this area and writing down what they encountered. Yet long before European Americans began carving out states and counties, and long before they began platting town sites, human beings traveled through and lived in this region. Today, we'll find out about those indigenous people, those Native Americans, who lived and roamed this area in the centuries before European Americans set foot here. What were their lives like? How did they live? Where did they go? And we'll also look into the people who arrived after white settlement began, Shawnee and Delaware and Wyandot, who were moved here from the East under agreement with the U.S. government. Our guest in the studio is Jim Fagans, President Emeritus of the Missouri Archaeological Society and past President of the Kansas City Archaeological Society. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Joining us from Dallas is R. David Edmonds of the University of Texas at Dallas. He's a historian of Native American people and of the American West. He has written 10 books covering the Oto Missouri, the Shawnee, and the Potawatomi.
Good morning.
And joining us from Emporia, Kansas, is Bryce Obermeyer, an anthropologist at Emporia State, who works closely with the representatives of the Delaware Nation and has written about them.
Good morning.
Let's begin by traveling back in time as far as we can, and I'll turn to you, Jim Fagans, for that. You've done a lot of archaeological work in our region. Who were the first human beings known to have been here, the first for whom we have any evidence?
Well, the first real evidence that we have, of course, is the Clovis. They lived during what we usually refer to as the Paleo-Indian period, or Paleo-American, as it's sometimes called. Those folks, we don't have a lot of evidence here, but we get their projectile points and so on.
How long ago was that era?
That was about 13,000 years ago.
Only 13,000 years ago?
Yes. For a historian, that kind of blows their mind, I'm sure.
I associate Clovis with farther southwest than this, but they...
That's right. The Clovis culture or occupation, if you will, it's used in a very broad sense sometimes. Those folks were named after Clovis, New Mexico, where the first remains of these people were found, their projectile points associated with prehistoric animals.
Now, I take it that there haven't been signs of settlement or of living here, just spear points and projectile points and things?
That's true, right in the immediate Kansas City area. Now, if you range a little farther out, we do find other evidence. And, of course, there are later groups also in the Paleo-Indian period that are here, and we do have some of their sites, like, well, there's surprisingly a Folsom site right in the city limits of Kansas City.
Where is that?
It's in the southern part of Kansas City, not too far from I-70.
Folsom, and once again, projectile points and small items like that?
Projectile points, scrapers, a variety of chipstone tools, yes.
Now, north of the river, there's quite a culture of the Hopewells. There's been sign of them, right?
That's correct. And they, of course, are much, much later in time. So we're skipping over a lot of cultures to come to them.
And they go back into the era before Christ.
Well, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not very far, but just barely.
Okay, sorry. Mainly
after Christ, kind of the ballpark figure, you could say, I suppose, for the Kansas City Hopewell.
What have I skipped over in skipping to the Hopewells from the Folsoms then?
Well, of course, there's a long, long period, the Archaic period, and we divide that into three parts for our convenience as archaeologists, early, middle, and late. And so we're talking thousands of years ending just before the time of Christ. And those folks were hunters and gatherers, although we do find surprising to a lot of people that at the tail end of that occupation, we do have a little bit of pottery, a tiny bit, with fiber temper here in this area, with the Nebo Hill culture.
And what's that named for?
Nebo Hill is named after a hill on the north side of the Missouri River here in the Kansas City area. A pioneer archaeologist, if you will, J. Met Shippey, is the one that named that. And he's pretty well known in this area. He's been dead now quite a little while. But those folks, if you want me to get into that part, they produced a distinctive kind of spear point, lancelet-shaped, kind of a diamond-shaped cross-section, and they had axes, three-quarter grooved axes. They had a variety of grinding tools, knives of various kinds made out of chert, C-H-E-R-T.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people aren't familiar with that. They think of, the general public thinks of flint, but essentially it's the same thing.
So, Jim Fagans, before we go on to meet our other guests, tell us how these folks wandered into our part of the world and left things.
It sounds like you're from your question that you want to go back to the beginning, because that's the folks that really wandered in.
Uh-huh.
We have a lot of theories relating to it. In fact, more now than we used to have as far as the Clovis folks. We also have some people that many of us refer to as pre-Clovis. That's a little bit controversial because it's still debated as to, were Clovis really the first people here, or were there folks before them? And there's getting to be more and more evidence to suggest that there were people here before them. Traditionally, we've said the Clovis arrived by way of Siberia, across the Bering Sea, coming down through Alaska, through a corridor in the ice, and then rapidly spread throughout the continent and into South America. We are finding more information that suggests that maybe there were more than one or two or three immigrations, some maybe by sea. There's some theories that are really controversial that maybe they even came by way of the East Coast. So there's a lot of interesting things that archaeologists argue back and forth about. But these folks, traditionally we've said they were big game hunters. We're talking about mammoths and mastodons and saber-tooth cats and those kind of creatures were living there. Of course, the prehistoric horse and camels and the American lion, those were all some of the animals that towards the tail end of the Pleistocene.
Even here in good old Kansas City area.
Even here in good old Kansas City, yes. As a matter of fact, in Missouri, we have the first really solid documentation that these folks were hunting mastodon. And there's a park not too far from St. Louis called Mastodon State Park. A catchy name, don't you think?
Gets to the point.
That's right. And they found these Clovis projectile points in the rib cage of these skeletons of these giant beasts. So pretty cool information.
It is indeed. And we'll come back to more of the prehistory after a second. That's fascinating, too. But then there comes a time when European Americans, explorers, and eventually settlers, fur traders, trappers, and then the English speakers who brought with them their plats and their town sites and so forth came. Dr. R. David Edmonds, you've done wide-ranging research and writing about Native Americans, including this era after, I think it's called After Contact. This meant a big change, obviously, for the Native Americans, but also for the European Americans who encountered them, didn't it?
Well, yes, and I think the juncture of the Kansas River and where the Missouri and the Kansas join is a kind of a critical area there. The Mississippi Valley with, at St. Louis was a spearhead for a lot of European early settlement, and people then, Caucasians, Europeans, went up the Missouri and then branched on up the Kansas and up the Platte. So the tribal people living in that region certainly had quite a bit of encounter with Europeans, first French and then Spanish and British, and eventually the Long Knives, as they were called, are the Americans.
Uh-huh.
And the predominant people living in the region in the very early period, of course, were some Missouri people, and the tribes just to the south of there who played a major role in the region, of course, were the Osages. But further west onto the plains of Kansas, then people such as the Kaw or the Kansa sort of held sway in the Kansas River Valley, and further west still, of course, people like the Pawnee, and coming in from the north or Odo, and people we call the Missouri people. So there was a large Native American population that had villages in the region and played an early history in the period.
How long had those groups, the Missouri, the Osage, the Kaw, even the Pawnee, been in this neck of the woods?
Well, I think it varies from group to group. We believe that the Osage had been there for a while. The Missouri had many of these people had come in from the east and had come up the river valleys and had established villages along the rivers. The rivers are the real avenues of penetration for people coming and going in this region until horses are introduced in the probably sometime in the middle 1700s. But much of the travel is either pedestrian until that time or on rivers. How long had they been there? It's sort of hard to say, in that their people did move around, and they contested among themselves over who would control the region. Tribal people coming in from Illinois and Indiana pushed into eastern Kansas and into northern Missouri. People like the Sauk and Fox, the Potawatomis, and the Shawnees, of course, come into eastern Missouri and then scatter out onto the plains by the time of the American Revolution. So there's quite a few people coming in and kind of moving around and vying for some control over the region.
What was the attraction to those early nations for this region?
Well, I think it's a very quite a bit of an attraction there. It's a transition zone between a prairie environment and then a little further west, obviously, onto the plains. But if you move east, it's into to the Ozark Plateau. So you have some ecological areas that overlap, and because of the overlap, different plants, different animals are available, and it was an area that attracted people. Moreover, there's quite a bit of trade going up and down the Missouri River, certainly in the early colonial period, but throughout the American period as well, and obviously as someone mentioned a while ago, during the Hopewell period. But so this was an avenue of trade prior even to the Europeans getting there. So it's an area that was quite attractive for commerce, for the production, or the gathering and the production of food. So it's an attractive area.
And as long as there were rivers and streams that were like the superhighways of the day.
Very much so.
Bryce Obermeyer at Emporia State, you've dealt extensively with the Delaware and written about them. How did they get to our part of the world?
Well, the Delaware would have represented groups that were moved into Kansas during the 19th century as part of the American removal policy to move tribes east of the Mississippi River, west of the Mississippi River. The Delaware would have arrived in Kansas when Kansas was part of a larger territory that included Nebraska and Oklahoma that was supposed to be designated as Indian territory. And part of the attraction, I think, for groups like the Delaware and the Wyandotte and the Shawnee, the Senecas, groups from the east, is that these represented what were formerly known in the 18th century as the Ohio Indians. And part of the aspiration, at least, of the Ohio Indians was to have eventually to be included in the Union as an Indian state. And I think part of the allure of Kansas and later Indian Territory or later Oklahoma was the idea that eventually these territories that were set aside as Indian Territory would be admitted into the Union as an Indian state.
Wow, but that idea then petered out as we got closer to the Civil War, didn't it?
Well, actually, it continued until Oklahoma statehood. And in fact, eastern Oklahoma at one point was the tribes of eastern Oklahoma were lobbying to have eastern Oklahoma not as eastern Oklahoma, but to be included as the Sequoia Territory or the Sequoia State. So there was a movement into the early 20th century, actually, to continue that dream among eastern woodland tribes of being admitted as one of the states.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Bryce Obermeyer at Emporia. Let me follow up on that Delaware question. The Delawares had a reservation in what we now call Kansas, but was then called Indian Territory in the 1820s and 30s, and now there is no more Delaware reservation here. Where are the Delawares today, and how did they get there?
The Delaware reservation, following the Civil War, like many of the reservations in Kansas, were dissolved through a slow but steady process of allotment and eventual removal of tribes from what would become Kansas to Indian Territory, or to what would later become Oklahoma. So in the Kansas City area, that would include the Delaware, the Shawnee, and the Wyandot, primarily from the Kansas City area.
So having been brought here or lured here in the 1820s and 30s, they were then dismissed from here?
Right. When American settlement turned its attention to, following the Kansas-Nebraska Act, turned its attention to establishing a presence in Kansas and Nebraska territory. At first, the idea was to allot the reservations to individual Indian people, to individual Shawnees and Delawares. And then by the end of the Civil War, that allotment was replaced with the choice, in many cases, for groups like the Delaware and the Wyandot and the Shawnee to either choose to remain in Kansas and become American citizens, or to give up their allotments in Kansas and to move to reservations in Oklahoma.
And that's why in places like Olathe and Shawnee, there are streets and things named for Chief Blue Jacket, who I believe was a Shawnee chief who sold his property or kept his property.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the chiefs were able to, because they were the ones that were negotiating these agreements and treaties and so forth, some of the chiefs were able to hold on to allotments while they were removed, and they continued to receive lease payments and so forth for lands in Kansas. But that was a very small minority of people that were able to hold on to their allotment. But you're absolutely right. If you were to look at the street names and the location names of the Kansas City side of Kansas from Olathe to Leavenworth, names like Tonganoxie and the Shawnee Mission, all of those are Delaware, Shawnee, Wyandot names and sites and locations. And a lot of the work that I do with the Delaware tribe is managing those sites that are still in the Kansas City metro area. Everything from burials, cemeteries, historic sites, and so forth. The tribes in Oklahoma are not too, although they were removed in the 19th century, they're not too far removed from Kansas and continue to have a presence in the Kansas City area.
Dr. David Edmonds, let's take a step back. You mentioned the Missouri, the Osage, and the Kansas Indians, the Kaw Indians, in our part of the world. The Kaw had a reservation in the Indian Territory, but what happened then to the Missouri and the Osage? How did they leave this part of the world?
Well, I think they left, as the previous speaker has pointed out, pretty much under the same pattern. Their lands in Kansas were purchased under some duress by the federal government, and these people were removed to Indian Territory, which would become part of Oklahoma. The Missouri and Oto, quite frankly, moved north originally out of Kansas and Missouri into southeastern and eastern Nebraska, where they held sway for a period of time, and then moved back along the Big Blue River on the Kansas-Nebraska border, and then eventually also ended up in north-central Oklahoma. I think another interesting facet of this whole period, however, is that the removal of some of the eastern tribes out of Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio into the western Missouri, Kansas region is a facet of westward expansion within the broader spectrum of our definition of that most people are unaware of. And the thing I would like to mention is that many of the tribal people who are moved into this region were relatively sophisticated people. Many of them were of mixed lineage, not all of them. But among the Potawatomis, for example, who ended up with a reservation west of modern Topeka, Kansas, they were placed in that region about the time the gold rush started to Colorado. And when the gold rush started to Colorado, the Potawatomis, who many of them had been merchants in the fur trade and people of that sort back in Indiana or Illinois or Michigan, set up ferries across the stream and charged immigrants so much to take them. They sold all kinds of fodder to people going west. There was a man, for example, a man named Joseph O'Gee, who ran a ferry just near Topeka and charged everyone $5 a wagon to get across the Kansas River. And this is near modern Uniontown. And one travel indicated in late May of 1849, if I remember correctly, that there were at least 70 wagons had lined up to get across there. So these people are very interesting in that it's an image of Native people that sometimes it's not understood by, let's say, the general public. Just as the five southern tribes, or the, quote, the five civilized tribes, sometimes come into eastern Oklahoma and set up relatively sophisticated cultures in an area that was not known for its sophistication among white people living there. The same thing happens on the Kansas frontier. We have really interesting descriptions of travelers like Horace Greeley passing through these settlements, saying, this is quite surprising. I stopped at a Native American owned a restaurant or inn called the Red Vermilion at Silver Lake, and he complained that if I'm not mistaken, he had the worst 50-cent meal he'd ever eaten. But at the same time, obviously these people are very good at being entrepreneurs, and it's an image of Native people that I think needs perhaps more exposure. They harvested, as I mentioned, they harvested crops. Ironically, the first McCormick's reaper to be used in Kansas was used by Potawatomi people near Silver Lake. So it's an interesting imagery that needs more exposure, I think.
And in fact, these people had already come into contact with white people back in the Indiana-Ohio area. Is that right?
Yes. Many of them were successful merchants, traders. They had an experience in dealing in the fur trade. Many of them were trilingual. They spoke English. They spoke French. They spoke their tribal languages. They maintained sort of trade networks stretching from Detroit to St. Louis. So they were relatively sophisticated people, and they realized the economic opportunities that were going to be available from the Colorado Gold Rush. So they prospered pretty well. Yes, they did.
In the late 1850s. Jim Fagans, there are three reservations in our part of the world, and they're all in Kansas, if I'm not incorrect. The Sac and Fox, the Potawatomi, and the Kickapoo. Those Native Americans, where did they come from, and why are they still here?
Well, they essentially came from back east also. Mm-hmm. And we've talked pretty much about the others except the Kickapoo. All of these tribes did not come westward in one continuous fluid movement, but they had many stops. Sometimes, in some cases, they divided up and had more than one reservation, or some people stayed behind for a while and then settled elsewhere. The Kickapoo, that's true of them. Now we not only have a reservation in Kansas, but there's also the Kickapoo tribe that left the United States. They moved down into Mexico, and they still live there, a little more primitive, if you will. I use that in quotes, than the tribal members up here. But sometimes those folks were forced west by one treaty, and then as the white folks intruded onto their reservations, they were often kind of glad to have another treaty to get away from some of the abuses that were heaped upon them. We talk about the Trail of Tears with the Cherokees. The Potawatomi had their Trail of Death, and a formal trail. It has markers all along the way. People can stop and look them up in different places where they were at as you travel westward.
Where does it go?
Well, it actually comes, part of it comes through the Kansas City area, but there's, in a sense, more than one trail because a lot of them are divided. And the same way with the Trail of Tears. There's not just one location for that trail, but there are divisions, and part of them go through southern Missouri in that case.
We'll be back after the break to talk more about life in our area before and just as European Americans came along. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking about times before European Americans arrived in the Kansas City area, when Native Americans crisscrossed the countryside, sometimes stopping and sometimes simply moving on. And we're finding out what happened after white people finally arrived in force. With us today are R. David Edmonds, who has researched and written extensively about Native Americans in the American West, Bryce Obermeyer, an anthropologist who works closely with the Delaware tribe and has researched their history, and Jim Fagans, a leading local archaeologist who has studied, among many other things, the Hopewell people in these parts. And Jim, we were talking about some of the three tribes that are still in Kansas and have made it to other places, and you had something to add.
Well, I wanted to mention a little bit about acculturization, where you have, in this case, Native Americans taking on additional aspects of the Euro-American culture, and they very much would pick and choose, just like people for centuries. When climates changed, or environments or politics changed, their relationship with neighbors changed, they would adapt, and so did the Native Americans. So sometimes we find that they will take on certain aspects of the Euro-American culture, and others they were more conservative. And that's kind of natural. Usually the religious end tends to be where they're more conservative. But the economic end, they would take the things that were useful to them, and the things that were not, often they were slow to adapt to that. So they were serving their own interests, and that's commendable. We all do that.
Let me throw this question open to anybody who wants to answer it. How did tribes become tribes?
I think the idea of, quote, tribe is maybe a European conceptualization that may be forced on some tribal people. I think people identified primarily as members of kin groups. And one was a member of an extended family. There was an intermixture, for goodness sakes, among Delawares and Shawnees and Wyandots, where people would marry outside of one's, quote, tribes. But one identified with one's kin group, one's extended family. And the idea of tribes and tribal governments, et cetera, are not so much tribes, but a centralized tribal government is a concept that very often was forced on tribes by Europeans. And it's an adaptation by tribal people who have to deal with the government, forming more centralization. But the centralized political idea of a paramount head chief is not a traditional Native American idea for most tribal people.
What about common languages? Is that how they form, or how they get defined that way?
I just would like to add on to that. I think Dr. Edmonds brings up a great point that what we perceive as tribal governments were really a response to dealing with European pressures for land, for negotiating treaties and so forth. And we know early on with the Delawares, for instance, there was in the 17th century and 18th century outright demands by the English and Six Nations for the Delaware to name a king, because there were so many potential leaders that it was difficult for them to deal with the Delawares for brokering land deals. And so part of that experience in Ohio that I mentioned was the emergence of a kind of centralized political authority that was really emerging as the body that was responsible for dealing with the British and later the United States for signing treaties and agreements and so forth.
But you mentioned the Six Nations. Somehow somebody somewhere figured there were six parts to this group of Native Americans. How are these six parts defined by themselves, mostly by the Europeans who met them?
Well, I think the Six Nations represents a unique pre-contact political organization, which is fascinating in and of itself. The Six Nations organization, in no small part, was served as kind of not a blueprint or a prototype, but at least something to draw from for our form of government. The Six Nations were six separate but culturally similar Iroquois groups that organized as independent tribes, to use that term, and who sent representatives to a central governing body. That governing body didn't have compelling force, but they made decisions, and the decisions could be followed or not followed. But it was that type of representative democracy in its truest form that the Six Nations was organized. But that was a unique type of confederacy, I think, to have existed prior to European contact.
And then another question I have is, there's the way these nations, tribes, groups were named. We know that the Kansas is named, I think we know, by the French trying to transliterate a word they could only hear, because there's no written Kansas language, into French, and then English people tried to transliterate the French into English. Is that right, guys?
Well, yes. I think another interesting thing is that most tribal groups have their own name for themselves. But very often we know them by a translation of the name that was used by the tribe immediately to, or the group immediately to the east. So when the French came among the Chippewa, they said, "Well, who are those people living to the west?" And the Chippewa say, "Nadewisu," which means basically rattlesnakes, but not as bad a rattlesnakes as the Iroquois are rattlesnakes. In other words, they're not so good. And so we know the word Apache, for example, is a Pueblo word meaning enemy. And this goes on and on and on. Obviously, the Delawares did not call themselves the Delawares.
Uh-huh.
So it's a series of the French primarily asking, or the Spaniards, well, who are those people, with a group of tribal people with whom they're familiar? And these tribal people say, oh, they are the so-and-sos. And that's where the name comes from.
The Delaware, what would the Delaware people themselves have called themselves in the at contact, Bryce?
The Delaware word for themselves is Lenape.
Lenape.
And it literally means the people. And that's exactly right. The name that Indian people have for themselves often translates as the people. Whether you're talking about the Diné or Navajo every group, well, not every, quite a few groups have two names that they identify with, a name that was, given to them by outsiders, as well as one that they would refer to as themselves.
And that's even true with the past. For example, you think of the word from the Southwest that we use to call the ancestors of the Pueblo in people. Anasazi, of course, is often translated as a Navajo word, which means enemy ancestors. They would see the buildings, the cliff dwellings, and so on of those folks, and they knew that their ancestors didn't build those. And so that's how that term arrived. And of course, politically nowadays, the Pueblo and people prefer that name not be used, since they don't consider themselves enemies of anybody, in a sense.
Well, that's a little far-fetched, far from Kansas City, but what name do they prefer?
Well, politically, of course, you have a lot of Puebloan groups, different tribes, the Zuni, Hopi, et cetera, et cetera. And collectively, a lot of times, they will simply refer to themselves as a Puebloan people.
Dr. Edmonds, the tribes such as the Kaw and the Osage and the Missouri and the Oto that you've written about, Do they have sites that archaeologists can dig up, or were they mostly travelers?
Oh, no. There are sites that are available. Even some of them are historic sites, in fact. There are some major Osage villages in Missouri that archaeologists have looked at. The cause, I'm not quite so sure about that. But they certainly, historic archaeology is very interested in excavation and in examination of these sites. Another tribe that we haven't mentioned that comes also into Kansas are the Kickapoos, and haven't talked about very much. And they, of course, are a people. There's a major Kickapoo site, for example, in central Illinois, the Grand Kickapoo Village of the Prairie, which has been more recently examined. And so certainly these people, Pawnee sites in Nebraska and have been examined as well. So these people have had their archaeological investigations as well. Sometimes there's some conflicts over what should be exhumed, et cetera, but that's another whole story, another whole program, I'm sure. But certainly they participated in it.
When Europeans first made contact with what we now call Native Americans, back in Europe, there were some people who gathered kind of an idealized view of them as uncorrupted. I believe that's where one way the phrase state of nature could be applied, uncorrupted, an ideal civilization that had existed before those of us other Europeans had gone to corrupt them. How close is that to reality, anybody?
Well, I think it's pretty naive. Once again, tribal people, I've always argued, are like every other people. We have good ones and we have bad ones, and some of us are better than others. And tribal people, certainly, it wasn't just a complete Disney created bliss. On the other hand, I think that the societies in all instances were very well adjusted to the environmental areas in which they lived. And they were societies that, generally speaking, were not dominated by the accumulation of material things. Now, you can say that's good or that's bad, depends upon your perspective. But I think Europeans, as they begin to industrialize, et cetera, begin to create sort of a myth of Native American people, and the myth continues. You say Indian to people, and they automatically think of Plains Indians on horses sweeping across the plain in mounted splendor, and of course that is one facet of Native American culture, but there were lots of other tribal people living in a lot of other different ways, and Kansas is, interestingly enough, it's a good crossroads of a lot of the different cultures.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Well, in line with that site, Bryce Obermeyer in Emporia, you mentioned that one of your jobs is to manage Delaware sites. Tell me, what kind of sites are those, and what do you do to manage them?
Well, of course, they're all historic sites. These would be sites that we would both manage in cooperation with the state, like the Grinner House in Kansas City would be one of these. Huh. The Grinner House was the first house to be built in what would become Kansas. It was one of these ferries that operated to cross the Kansas River. It was built by a white trader that married a Delaware woman, but it became a kind of the hub for the Delaware Reservation during its time here. It also includes cemeteries that are still here in Kansas. There's one at the White Church in Kansas City that includes Delaware burials from before Kansas statehood. Always like the Ketchums were an integral part of the Methodist mission here, and their graves are still there. Also, graves that were unmarked. We have a grave in a housing subdivision, actually, in Bonner Springs that the developer was kind enough to hand over one of the house plots and agreed not to build on the house plot. And so we have a grave that actually has an address, a mailing address there in Bonner Springs. But so sites like that, primarily historic sites, cemetery sites, there's an occasional archaeological scatter. We also keep records of where some of the important chiefs, where their allotments were, and where they remained after Kansas statehood. And so those would be the types of sites that we, in Kansas, that we manage. And when I say manage, we keep a record of where the location of these sites are, and if there's ever any projects, like the road project that that you mentioned in Topeka that uncovered Fool Chief's Village, if there's ever any types of projects like that, we get involved and we make sure that the site is protected or at least mitigated in a way that the tribe is comfortable with, much in the same way that the state did with Fool Chief's Village. We were actually a part of that excavation. We weren't a part of the excavation, but we were included as consulting parties along with the CAW, and they were very aware of the excavation. And I think that's an important part that you bring up here, and that the tribes, while they may not be in Kansas like the Kansas and the Delaware, through their historic preservation offices, they are still interested in maintaining a presence. They know their cemeteries are here. They know their sites are here. Their former village sites are here, and they continue to have an interest in the state.
And you act on their behalf in these matters.
I do. Yeah, I serve as the director for their historic preservation office. And for political reasons between the Delawares and the Cherokees, it's actually become easier for us to have a historic preservation office here in Kansas as opposed to Oklahoma. At Emporia State, they were able to give us some office space here on campus, and we have one of the few tribal historic preservation offices that are on a university campus here at Emporia State.
The Delaware and Cherokee, I take it, are in northeastern Oklahoma today?
They are, and the politics are fairly well known. It's when the Delawares were moved from Kansas, they were not given their own reservation, but were moved on to the Cherokee Nation. And as part of that move, they were obliged to become Cherokee citizens. And it was a move that the Delawares never were really committed to, and nor were the Cherokees, truly. And so there's been differences over Delaware independence or not independence, and it's kind of ebbed and flowed based on the changes in federal policy. And as it stands now, the Delawares and the Cherokees are on good footing with one another and working together. But one of the ways in which we're working together is by, looking in other places for a presence.
Now, after European contact, there came, let me try to put this politely, a mingling among the sexes, where some European Americans and some Native Americans, got together. That was widespread on the frontier, or was it only a small proportion, guys? How widespread was that?
Well, I would argue that it's very widespread. It's people of mixed lineage have emerged wherever Europeans and Native people have come together, and it continues. I think it's a interesting issue. One of the major issues, it seems to be the primary issue for tribal people in the 21st century, is exactly the definition of who is a Native American. Mm-hmm. And do you define it through lineage, which the federal government, that's an imposition the federal government has put on us, and that it's going to be a blood quantum, and you're one half, one eighth, one quarter, blah, blah, blah. Or do you define it culturally by a subscription to a certain series of cultural values? And different tribes work this out different ways. But in terms of the intermarriage of people on the frontier, my goodness, it's always been going on, and many of the tribes have intermarried. That doesn't mean that they're any more Native American, any more Indian, or less. It just means that that's part of a frontier experience.
Yeah, and I would even argue that intermarriage was, in fact, a strategy for surviving the frontier experience for many tribal groups. We see historically, even before the move to Kansas, that one of the strategies of not only European traders, but as the Delawares were often moved into territories of other peoples, other Indian peoples, so much like Europeans, they had to find ways to adapt. They had to find ways to establish alliances. And marriage was one of the best ways to do that. And I think Europeans just simply continued a pattern as they sort of followed along that wave of American expansion. French traders and later Americans would intermarry with groups as a strategy of, dealing with, surviving, living in the frontiers that were the territories of other peoples. And it just was a simple fact of living at that time.
I would even go as far as to argue that given the sophistication of many of the tribal people on the frontier within the five southern tribes of Oklahoma and even in Kansas, et cetera, that for white men moving into those regions, marrying into the Indian nations, was a step up socially and economically.
Absolutely.
Because they had access to tribal land. For example, the literacy rate on the Cherokee Nation is higher than that of the White South up through the Civil War.
My.
So when you think of people on the frontier, I'm not trying to denigrate anybody who lived in Kansas at a very early time, but I might suspect there was many people there that resembled Festus, as did Matt Dillon. And consequently, marrying into the nations was to their advantage.
Yeah, I would agree.
That's correct, and it's not just from the economic standpoint. It's also prehistorically, right into the proto-historic and later. Also, sometimes it was a very necessary to survive for tribes to work together for defense against other tribes.
Mm-hmm.
You have these intermarriages that solidify groups, and so that's very, very important. And I agree with all these gentlemen here, what they've said about this, but it also is more than just economics.
Well, the history of the world is replete with nations merging with or subduing other nations. I think of the Angles and the Saxons and the British and the Normans and the Romans and the Gauls. Is the experience here in the Northern Hemisphere, is it really that different from those other experiences?
No, I don't think so. Prehistorically, it's hard for us to sometimes sort all this out because the coarse grainedness that we have with the archaeological remains, but I'm sure it's occurred, and we do see examples of cultural materials that have been traded and intermingled, and back in prehistoric times, we find there's shells from the Gulf of Mexico, and we have shells even in towards the end of the late Archaic period out here on the plains from the Gulf of California, Baja California area. So trade certainly would be an important factor there in which archaeologically we can identify some sort of interaction. But the exact nature of marriage and all of that is pretty hard to sort out without lots of DNA and so on, which is almost impossible to get.
As our understanding of the West and American movement into the West has evolved over the years, it's come a long way from the notion at the turn of the 19th and the 20th century that it was important to subdue Indian tribes because they were just murderous folks out to kill white people. It's come a long, long, long way around to a greater understanding of the Native Americans. In fact, a great deal of sympathy for them. But is the American experience that different from the experiences of other nations in the rest of the world?
Well, I think, to a certain extent, no. We have a colonial power. The United States is expanding into an area and taking it over. And tribal people are not exactly colonized, but they work within a framework of similar situation. But there's even a broader pattern here. Now, I'm not an archaeologist, but I would make an argument that if you look at in terms of North America fitting into a world pattern, if you look at Eurasia, you can see that, quote, sophisticated societies grew up along rivers. And eventually they rise and they fall and then they last. Well, if you look at the Hopewell and the Dena and the Mississippian situation in the eastern part of the United States, you have a similar pattern. You have the rise and the fall of relatively sophisticated cultures. So I think rather than seeing United States or what becomes the United States as apart from the general mainstream of world history, if there is one, I think we fit into it rather well. It's just that we've tended to look at American history starting in 1492, and we've ignored what went on prior to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that it fits very much into a world pattern.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Well, I've got to ask one last question, and we'll start with you, Jim Fagans. How did you get so interested in archaeology?
I kind of came to archaeology really by the back door. I suppose if you would really go to the very beginning, it was when I was a kid growing up on a farm.
Mm.
And we had some land down along the Little Osage River, and there were these Indian artifacts in a field, and across the road there was some more Indian artifacts. And as an 11-year-old boy, I noticed then that the artifacts from those two almost adjoining fields were not alike, made from different chert and different styles. And so I suppose one would say that was the nuclei of my fascination, of pretty exciting stuff for a kid.
David Edmonds in Dallas. How did you get interested in Native Americans?
Well, my family's of Native origin, so I've always been interested in it. And although I'm trained as a chemist of all things, but the point being, I'm one of the luckiest people in the world, because if I wasn't doing this as a profession, I'd be doing it anyway. And I've done it for more years than I wish to remember, and I've been paid for it. So that's why. I mean, this has been my life.
And Bryce Obermeyer?
I'd have to say my story was much more like Jim's. I grew up on a farm in eastern Nebraska, in the Peru Hills, just along the Missouri River, and had a farm, and we would walk the fields and find our artifacts may not have been as exciting as the ones Jim's were describing. Most often I would find cow bones, but I think that started my fascination with archaeology and what you could tell from the past, and just growing up with town names and place names that were county names, you know, like Oto and Pawnee and so forth, and just being interested on a general level, well, who are they? What is Oto? What is Missouri? Where is this coming from? And the more I looked into it, realized that, you know, what we were learning in the elementary school, that these were Indian people that lived in teepees and but they're no longer here, was actually not only false, but almost a racist way of teaching our children, or teaching me. I got it more interested in actually talking to, as a cultural anthropologist, talking to the descendants of the people who had left, you know, those artifacts. And as a graduate student, I was fortunate enough to help the Delawares with an oral history project, and I've been working with them ever since on their historic preservation issues.
And that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guests, Jim Fagans, President Emeritus of the Missouri Archaeological Society and past President of the Kansas City Archaeological Society, Dr. Bryce Obermeyer, anthropologist at Emporia State University, who handles issues for the Delaware tribe, R. David Edmonds, author of The Oto Missouri People, Ann and Chester Watson Chair and History Professor at the University of Texas in Dallas. You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs on the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Join us again Monday as we look at changes to tax law for the last year and how changes in business climate could affect retirement income. Up to Date is next to tingle your taste buds with food flavoring. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Kate Baxendale. I'm Munro Dodd. This is KCUR, and enjoy your weekend.